there are so many wonderful, larger-than-life, colorful characters who make cameos, but I open the book with a quote by Edgar Allan Poe, who I will call Margaret Fuller's frenemy. He said, there are three categories of humanity, men, women, and Margaret Fuller. And so that just that was sort of a begrudging compliment when Poe made the comment. But it speaks to the fact that she was this singular individual and occupied a place unto herself.
Welcome to Historical Fiction Unpacked. I'm your host, Allison Treat. Hello, readers, and welcome back to the show. This is episode 11 of season 7, and today I am sharing a conversation I had with New York Times best-selling author Allison Pataky. We talked about her new book, Finding Margaret Fuller, which just released on Tuesday. So we talk about everything about this book and about Allison's career and about the fact that we have the same name, although it's spelled differently. So this conversation is a great one and you're going to love it. So I will get right to it. Allison, thank you for joining me on the show today. I've actually never had another Allison on the show, so that's fun.
Thank you so much for having me. And I'm glad we can get past the initial disagreement over how to spell the name correctly, one or two L's.
Yeah, I'm willing to have some grace about that. So
it has got to be one of the names with the greatest number of variety options for spelling.
Yeah, I think so. I did have your brother on the show. I don't know if you realized that a few years ago.
Yeah,
that was fun. Yeah. So it's nice to talk to you, though. So your latest novel, Finding Margaret Fuller, just released on Tuesday. Can you tell me about this book?
Absolutely. So Finding Margaret Fuller is my 10th book. It is a historical fiction novel about the life of America's forgotten leading lady, Margaret Fuller, who is at the center of this genius cluster of great thinkers and writers. We all know the names Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau, Nathaniel Hawthorne, Louisa May Alcott. Well, Margaret Fuller is the woman who Ralph Waldo Emerson referred to as the radiant genius and fiery heart at the center of their whole circle. And yet her name is the least well known. She was the inspiration for Nathaniel Hawthorne in writing Hester Prynne. She was mentor to Louisa May Alcott. She was muse to Emerson. Just this fascinating, epic life story. But largely her name has become a footnote in history. So I'm putting her squarely center stage where I think she belongs and telling this biographical historical fiction based on her life.
Yeah, that's great. I love that. So, and it's so fascinating. I mean, with all the famous real life characters in this book. So what was your inspiration?
Yeah. I just have to say, in terms of there are so many wonderful, larger than life, colorful characters who make cameos, but I opened the book with a quote by Edgar Allan Poe, who I will call Margaret Fuller's frenemy. He said, there are three categories of humanity, men, women, and Margaret Fuller. And so that was sort of a begrudging compliment when Poe made the comment. But it speaks to the fact that she was this singular individual and occupied a place unto herself with her brilliant mind and colorful personality. But the inspiration was really, I found this nonfiction biography about this clique of great thinkers I just mentioned, this genius cluster of Emerson, Alcott, Thoreau, Hawthorne, Melville. And Margaret Fuller was the sixth character in this book. And this was nonfiction. This was straight up fact. I hadn't realized that they were all living together. Literally, Thoreau was Emerson's handyman living upstairs.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
House. The Alcotts were just up the road. The Hawthorns were just in the other direction. And Margaret Fuller was living there too in Concord in the mid-19th century with Emerson and all these characters. And the book was called American Bloomsbury, and it was a story of this moment in time when all these great thinkers, the transcendentalists, were living together, working together, falling in and out of love, falling in and out of lust, falling in and out of friendship. And it was really the story behind the stories that we all know and grow up reading and study in school. And I knew about all these characters except for Margaret Fuller. And yet she jumped off the page and I was like, that is the story. That is the character. I want to tell that story. And I knew I had met my next leading lady. I love writing the stories of forgotten women from history. And she leapt off the page for me, and I knew I had to write her life story.
Yeah, that's great. So what do you most enjoy about writing about these lesser known women in history?
I love the moment that happens at the beginning when I'm first getting hooked, where I think, how have I never heard this before? I love history. I am a lifelong book nerd. And yet when I come across these characters from history, where I know about their time period, I know about the other characters in the moment in time, usually predominantly men, the male figures. And then when I happen upon these women who were there, who not only had a front row seat to witnessing history, but had an active hand in shaping it and participating in it and changing it, changing history. I love that moment of, oh my goodness, how did I not know her name? I've got to learn everything I can, and then I've got to tell her story. And what I really love is how time and again, I just find this history that is so juicy, so dramatic, so fascinating. History is the furthest thing from boring. And I love telling stories that bring history and bring these women to life for readers.
Once you knew that you wanted to write about her, how did you go about researching Margaret's life and those of the other historical figures in the novel?
Yeah. So the first step for me was going to Concord and entering into the world, entering into the place where Margaret Fuller said she considered the paradise of thought. It was here in Concord in the mid-19th century where all of these people were living together, and it was a relatively new country, America, and they were really charting this decade of creating the American canon of literature and the arts. Right. And Margaret was right there. So I had to go to Concord. I had to go to the Emerson House. I had to go to the Alcott House, Orchard House. Had to go to the Hawthorne House. Had to walk in Margaret's footsteps where she was, you know, walking the trails of the forest out to Walden Pond with her friend Thoreau as he was considering moving out to a cabin in the woods, really entering into her world and soaking up as many of these rich historical details as I could. And oh my goodness, if you haven't been to Concord, it is so worth a visit. It is a town that just honors and celebrates its history, and I was in heaven. And I would highly recommend a visit. And then really from there, once I've, you know, with all of my books, with Cece, it was going to Vienna, going to Budapest, the Habsburg Empire. You know, with Desiree, it was going to Paris and absorbing Napoleonic and French Revolutionary history. With Marjorie Post, it was going to Hillwood, going to Camp Topridge, going to Palm Beach. So for Margaret, it really started in Concord, and then just taking in as much of the history and the biography and the nonfiction, the fact, taking in as much as I can. And with Margaret, she was such a prolific writer. I had the great privilege of reading her own words, reading her own voice. And so then at a certain point in the process, once I've taken in as much as I can, the historical figure morphs into this character in my head who begins talking to me and almost like takes my hand and begins to lead me down the path of this story. And that's when I really know I'm ready to transition from the heavy upfront research to the writing, the drafting. And then obviously I research as I go. And I know, as an example, that this one particularly awkward family dinner occurred in the Emerson House when Margaret was staying with the Emersons, and Emerson's wife asked Margaret to walk with her after the meal. And she said, "I'm sorry, but your husband already asked me to walk with him first." And so then Mrs. Emerson bursts into tears and leaves the table. And you know from the historical record that these moments happened, but then I get to write them. And as I'm writing them, I'm like, oh, what would they have been eating at a meal in this year, in the mid-1900s in Massachusetts? So then I'm doing on-the-spot research for those facts. But really, the research is front-loaded, and I do a big push in the beginning so that the story can come to life for me.
Sure, that makes sense. How do you walk that fine line when you're writing about people who actually existed, and you're writing a fiction novel. How do you balance that?
That is the balance. That is the dance and negotiation, and it's truly different each time, depending on what the historical record is giving me, how much is readily available. With a woman like Desiree, who was centuries ago in France, in a time of revolution and upheaval, there were gaping holes in the historical record. With a woman like Marjorie Post, whose daughter passed away while I was researching, this is very recent history. It's very well documented. Her home is a museum dedicated to preserving her life archives. So everything was available. Margaret was somewhere in the middle. Margaret, it was very well documented because these transcendentalists were prolific writers. They wrote about everything. They wrote letters. And, you know, this was thankfully before cell phones and text messaging and emails. So it's all there. The papers are preserved. So I stuck to the record with the history because honestly, the raw material was so good, I'd be crazy not to. I didn't need to make anything up because the real story of Margaret Fuller's life was just that outlandish. Everything from hanging in Paris with Frederic Chopin to hanging in England with Wordsworth to taking part in the Roman Revolution, taking a lover, having a child, sparking an international scandal, inspiring Nathaniel Hawthorne to write the character of Hester Prynne. It was all there. So what I would say is the history really gives me the bones of the story. I lay down that track based on what actually happened, the dates, the events, the characters who were there. And then what I get to do as the novelist, because I'm not writing biography, is I get to go and I put on the flesh. I add the color. As I said, I know this moment in time happened. I get to write it so that the reader enters into it as a witness and a participant, a fly on the wall who gets to experience it. So the biographer is writing what happened. For me as the novelist, I'm writing how it felt. That's paraphrasing an E.L. Doctorow quote, but that's really what I'm doing. I'm trying to get, we know the truth or, you know, the fact of the historical record. I'm trying to get at the heart truth and what it felt like, what it would be like to experience and enter and inhabit those moments. And so that's what I love. And I love that as a reader of historical fiction too. So I love being able to do that as a writer of historical fiction.
Right. That's great. So why do you think that Margaret isn't remembered or celebrated like the other transcendentalists are?
Such a great question and something I have spent so much time thinking about. First and most obvious reason is, I think, because she was a woman, she was not able to tour the country and get paid to speak and write the way some of her male contemporaries like Emerson were. She didn't have inherited wealth like some of the men in her circle were that afforded her the leisure and the privilege of writing and thinking and choosing how to spend her great intellect and brilliance the way some of these men were. Margaret always had to work full time as a teacher, a governess, a tutor, a reporter. And so then the output of her passion projects had to happen in the pre-dawn hours, in the nighttime hours. And so that just impacted the day-to-day of her life and what she logistically and physically could put out. But then I think the other huge tragedy of this is, and I don't want to spoil the ending for those who haven't read the full ending yet, the way we see her life end. I think that's the tragedy. We can only guess what might have happened, right? If things had ended differently for her.
Right.
And then it was the time in which she lived. She was a woman about a century ahead of her time. Mm-hmm. And we know she felt, because she said it very openly, that the greatest work of her life was the work she was working on at the end of her life. And we see what happens there. And again, I'm not going to spoil. Hopefully that will entice people to read through to the end. But in terms of cementing her name. And then her great, probably most well-known, celebrated still to this day work is Woman in the 19th Century. It is considered by so many to be the founding document of the American women's rights movement. She was a mentor to Elizabeth Cady Stanton. She led her in conversations, in these tutorial conversations when Elizabeth Cady Stanton was a young woman. These women, Susan B. Anthony, Lucretia Mott,
Yeah.
Elizabeth Cady Stanton, they wanted Margaret Fuller to be the founding mother of their movement. And you'll see what happens if you read this book and why that didn't happen. And then I think finally, you know, I had this thought when I went to Concord and I went to the cemetery and I visited Author's Ridge, and you see Emerson and Thoreau and the Alcotts resting side by side in perpetuity, as they did in life. You know, they were always together. And I had this thought, the gang's all here except for Margaret. Margaret was always, when it came to this transcendentalist circle, I felt she was always a little bit of an outsider. She had to leave Concord, and she said, Concord is lacking in discord. She wanted more than simply poetry and philosophy and walking through the woods and debating these grand topics of self-reliance or equal rights for men and women, equal rights for Black and white citizens. So she left and she went to New York and then London and then Paris and then Rome because she wanted to get her hands dirty in the gritty day-to-day reality of life. She wanted to work. She wanted to move humanity forward. She wanted to visit prisons. She wanted to visit orphanages. She wanted to interview female prostitutes. She wanted to get into the actual stuff of society. And so she left Concord, and as a result, she's not celebrated there and memorialized there the way the rest of the transcendentalists are. And I think she was okay with that. But I think it was a dilemma of her life. She was part of this group of great thinkers. In many ways, she was a leader among them. But she knew she couldn't stay. She knew she had to leave. She knew she needed a broader canvas. And she always craved, you know, fresh soil in which to expand and grow and thrive. And so that's the beauty and the tragedy of the arc of her story that you see time and again, is this restlessness, this need to evolve and grow and transform and challenge herself.
Right. Interesting. So how do you think that she, or in what ways do you think that she influenced America's literary greats?
She was a muse to Ralph Waldo Emerson. He told his pal, Nathaniel Hawthorne, that she was the one woman in the world worth considering. He considered her like a goddess on a pedestal because she was his intellectual equal. And they really had this connection that went beyond an intellectual connection. It was sort of a soulmate experience in these years when they were really close. And then she inspired and mentored Louisa May Alcott in multiple of her books. But what's interesting is when Louisa May Alcott publishes Little Women, about her time growing up in Concord, near and with Margaret Fuller, she changed the eldest daughter's name from Anna to Margaret as a nod to her childhood heroine. And then you have Nathaniel Hawthorne writing The Scarlet Letter about a brazen, iconoclastic, free-spirited, defiant, brave, beautiful brunette who bucks society's censure and disapproval to follow her heart. Who was the brazen, trailblazing, free-spirited, scandalous, beautiful brunette in his life? Well, let's just say when Mrs. Hawthorne read the first draft of The Scarlet Letter, she took to bed for the rest of the day with a headache. Because she knew her husband's book was not about her. It was about the woman who had been living up the road, who had tormented her husband. So Margaret's impacts are fascinating and numerous. And yet somehow, I don't think that many people know the full extent of her life and legacy.
No, I'm sure they don't, because I had no idea. I want to ask you a little bit more about your career. How did you get to this place as a best-selling author? Like, how have you always loved to write? Tell me about the path you took in getting here.
I have always loved stories. I have always loved to read. I have always loved to write. And I've always found such inspiration in history. I have so many memories of my childhood. I was the third of four kids, so no one ever really cared or knew where I was. And I have these memories of just wandering around in the woods near where I grew up in upstate New York, just being completely lost in these stories in my head, just telling these stories, making these stories up. And still to this day, I can't go to sleep at night without being lost in a story in my head. That's just where my brain goes. But I thought my love of history, my love of storytelling, my love of inquiry and story investigating, I thought the logical fit was journalism. And mm-hmm. so that was where I went right out of school. That was my first career, was I spent several years writing for live television news and for online news. And then I would hustle home at the end of the long, exhausting shift in the newsroom, and I'd get up my laptop and I'd start writing fiction. And it was like this release. It was this secret, dirty little secret hobby that I had, my side hustle that mm-hmm. I loved, but that I didn't really feel like I could tell anyone about because I wasn't a writer. I worked in news. Who was I to think I could write fiction or novels? I had no training in that. And so 3 books later, sitting as finished manuscripts on my computer that I had spent weekends, nights, vacations working on, I thought, maybe I'm in the wrong line of work. Maybe I am a writer, but I don't want to be writing news where I'm miserable. Maybe I should be writing longer form fiction. And so for me, the critical step was getting a literary agent and having a partner. I knew I wanted to do the writing. I knew I wanted to do the research. I didn't know anything about the industry. I didn't know how to, if what I was doing was any good or worth pursuing. When I found this literary agent who, like me, was at the start of her career, the starting line, she was building her business. She was building her experience. It was the Great Recession of 2008. No publishers wanted to take an unknown entity. I had this book about the American Revolution, which this was before Hamilton. So I was told the American Revolution does not sell. The American Revolution is not sexy. Martha Washington is not sexy. I said, Martha Washington may not be sexy, but Peggy Shippen Arnold is sexy. I'm telling you, Benedict Arnold, John Andre, this plot to betray America, this is good. And eventually I convinced someone to buy into what I was selling. I had my first book, The Trader's Wife, with Simon & Schuster at, it was 2012. I sold that. It was my literary agent's first work of fiction that she sold.
Oh, wow.
We were babies, totally naive, coming up, you know, with this, the luck of the innocent at the start of our career. And I just knew I wanted to tell stories, and I just knew I wanted to pour everything I had into launching this book and getting this story out. I was passionate. It was, to me, local history, the story of Peggy Shippen Arnold. And so I sold the first book, The Trader's Wife. And after that book came out, it did incredibly well. It hit the New York Times bestseller list as a paperback. And my publisher said, okay, great. You've burst down the door now for the American Revolution. You've proven that it can sell. You got to find another forgotten woman from the American Revolution. Tell that story. Make that your thing. Make that your niche. And I said, I'm so sorry, but I've already written my next book. It's Empress Sisi of the Habsburg Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire at the start of World War I. Another woman you've never heard about. And I'm like giving them whiplash. I'm like, let's jump across the Atlantic Ocean to a different country, a different century. But really, it's been an organic process for me. And it has been a compulsion and an obsession every time. I find these women and I just think, I have to know everything I can about this story. And then I've got to tell this story. And I become so obsessed. And I tell my husband, I say, I've been bitten. I know when I found my next book, the story gets its teeth in me. And I'm just willing to give my life to telling the story and then hopefully spending the rest of my life meeting with readers and talking about it with readers. So, it's so 10 years later, 10 books later, I love it. It's the adage, if you find what you love to do, you never work a day in your life. And that's how I feel about writing historical fiction.
That's awesome. I love that. So can you tell us what you're working on next, or is that a secret?
I have my next woman. It's 20th century. It's America again.
Great.
And I can't say her name, but I can say it's scandalous and sexy, and I can't wait to share more. It's very soon.
Great. So this is a question I ask all my guests. How do you think learning about history through story helps us approach life in the present?
I love that. Well, I think historical fiction does this wonderful thing. It's this wonderful opportunity for readers to not only be educated, but also entertained. I think historical fiction is accessible and inviting in a way that a really thick, dense biography might not feel at first. Right. I think historical fiction provides a great entryway into history. And I can't tell you how many readers have said, I didn't learn history like this in school. If I had, I wouldn't have thought history was boring. And that's exactly right. History is the furthest thing from boring. But I think historical fiction can bring readers in. And then what I hope they find in my books is that these women are inspiring. These women changed the world with the tools and the talents that they had in the moments in time in which they lived. And I hope that women and men, the readers now, enter into the story, find it to be transportive and immersive, but also hopefully it helps them find inspiration for their own lives, because history is accessible, but it's also so relatable. You know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. And that is true. You have a woman like Margaret Fuller, whose story is incredibly timely and relevant today. So I hope readers really feel that and connect to the story in a way that feels personal and resonant.
Right. Yeah, I love that. Well, Allison, this has been a wonderful conversation. What is the best way for listeners to follow you?
So listeners can find me, AllisonPataki.com. Two L's, unlike you, Allison. So my name, AllisonPataki.com. That's my website. I'm on social media, Instagram, Facebook. You can sign up for my newsletter at my website, AllisonPataki.com. And I love hearing from readers. So please let me know where you're reading my book, what you think. I love hearing from you. I'm thankful for it every single time. It means so much to us to hear from people who, you know, it's a huge deal to give your time, your money, your attention into going on this journey with me by reading my book. And so I'd love to hear from you. And I appreciate every single one of you.
Great. Awesome. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Happy reading, everybody. Happy Women's History Month.
Well, friends, I hope you enjoyed that conversation. Make sure you visit the show notes and get all the links to Allison's books and her website and other ways to follow her. As always, if you can't get to the show notes in your listening app, you can find them at allisontreat.com/blog. That's allisontreat.com/blog. If you'd like to help out the show, please follow us or subscribe to new episodes, rate and review the podcast. And if you think of someone who would really enjoy this episode, be sure to share it with them. That helps the show too. To close out, I'd like to leave you with some words from Margaret Fuller herself. She said, "Give me the truth, cheat me by no illusion." So keep reading historical fiction, my friends, and I will talk to you again next week.